I'm Craig Murray. I'm a journalist and a human rights campaigner, and I'm standing here in Blackburn for George Galloway's Workers' Party, primarily to oppose the genocide in Gaza and specifically to stand against the Labour Party's effective support for the genocide, but also to stand against the shift of the Labour Party under Keir Starmer until it's actually to the right of the Conservative Party and to give left-wing people a choice to vote for.
Look, the Conservatives under Rishi Sunak have been actively supporting this. Surely, by standing against Starmer and the Labour Party, you're just helping them.
I don't think so. I mean, it looks like there's almost certainly going to be a Labour government in power. Personally, don't think a government by Starmer will be any better than a government by Sunak. I think it would be very much all of the same. The two parties are both conservative parties, and anybody who's been watching the debates between Sunak and Starmer will have been seeing Starmer attack Sunak from the right, not from the left. He's been saying that Labour would be tougher on immigration. Labour would also like to send asylum seekers to Africa on aeroplanes. Labour would increase defence spending by more. Labour would cut public spending by more and impose more austerity. It's a race to the bottom of right-wing populism, and they're both right-wing populist parties. So I absolutely don't care whether Sunak or Starmer is in power. I think Sunak is probably a little less dangerous to civil liberties than Starmer is.
Okay, so what about other policies? Because when people vote in a general election, Craig, they're not just voting for Palestine, are they? They want to vote for conditions and policies that are going to actually make things better here in Britain.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And I think we're really pretty well the only party that has any policies that will make anything better in any way for anybody who isn't a billionaire. We want to bring in a properly left-wing agenda, and that involves making the stinking rich pay a bit more tax, which everyone seems terribly averse to. But in a country where here in even in this little town of Blackburn here, well, big town, almost a city, we have a number of billionaires live here, and every day there are scores of people lining up for food banks to be able to feed their children. That's just wrong. We want to see proper taxation, which is aimed at redistribution of wealth as an actual objective. We want to see fundamental changes to the way the system of the economy works, whereby concentration of capital favors those who already have capital, whereby the way to get housing is to have a bit of capital already, to leverage that to get more and more capital, purchase more and more properties, until landlordism has become a plague across the entire country. And people who don't have capital and can't put down a deposit for a mortgage end up paying far more in rent than they would up if they had to pay a mortgage on the property. So they never get to own anything, and capital gets more and more and more concentrated. And that's only in one sector of the economy how it works. It's effectively the same thing in all sectors. We want to nationalize the utilities, nationalize water, nationalize gas and electricity, nationalize the railways again. Because the profiteering that's going on and the stripping of tens of billions, in fact, indeed hundreds of billions in total of pounds of profit for shareholders out of our utilities, while very little has been put back in investment and we are filling our rivers with sewage, ought to be a national disgrace. We've reached the stage where the extreme extension of late capitalism we've reached now has become totally dysfunctional and just doesn't work for the majority of the population. And we're the only party but just trying to actually do something about that.
Yes, but where are you going to get the money from? You say from the super rich, and these are like pipe dreams. I mean, surely the government with this massive national debt just simply cannot afford to do this kind of thing. We haven't got the money to go and purchase all these utilities back again. And even so, how are you going to to shift ownership of masses of property. This is something, it sounds to me like you're not taking on the Tories so much as taking on the entire financial system single-handed.
Yep, I think that sounds a very fair description, and that's what has to be done, because unfortunately we live in a HELOC society, but for the vast majority of people, simply doesn't work. And who talked about paying compensation when we nationalised the industry? Certainly all the dividends that shareholders have been taken off have to be deducted from the value of any compensation that they get. And, you know, if we want to find money to bomb Libya, or if we want to find £100 billion to give to try to spark a nuclear war in Ukraine, that money's found very easily. And it's found by printing it, which, of course, is how the government ends up with this massive national debt of which you talk. And it's simply innumerable. It's ludicrous to compare the finances of a government which can produce a fiat currency and which was able to produce pretty well $1 trillion in quantitative easing to help the banks by simply creating new currency when it wanted to help bankers. Your idea that that can't be done to help the NHS or to abolish tuition fees or to free social care, of course it can. It's a matter of, does the government create money and give it to the super wealthy in the financial institutions, or does the government create money and use it for providing utilities, for providing public services, which actually create much more employment rather than simply concentrate capitals far more on the super rich?
I think it's fair to say quite a lot of people are thinking and saying in pubs, oh, these two parties, they're getting closer and closer. There's not much between them. I keep hearing this term, the uniparty, about Labour and Conservatives. So it is quite likely that people may be spending their votes on fringe parties this time, Craig. The only thing is, in these election debates, I haven't seen Sunak or Starmer up against George Galloway from the Workers' Party. They seem to have thought that they want to have the top seven parties, so that's Labour and Conservative, Green, Plaid Cymru, SNP, what's the other ones? There's a couple more anyway. Of course, Reform UK. But not, they seem to have cut off the eighth biggest party being George's. And we haven't really seen him at all. I wonder whether, I mean, I'm looking at this thinking this is an arbitrary amount that they've decided, only the top seven. And this means that we've not had those brilliant, fiery debates that we could have had directly between Starmer and Galloway.
That's absolutely true. And whatever people say about George, he's undoubtedly the best debater on the parliamentary scene at the moment. It would have been brilliant to see him in that. But of course, you're not allowed to have left-wing thoughts, whereas Reform, who have no MPs at all and a very poor track record of fighting elections, just like UKIP, you know, get promoted by the BBC. They're creations of the BBC and the mainstream media, because the entire aim, all the media, is controlled either by the billionaire class or by the state, and the state is controlled by the billionaire class. And the whole aim of Reform is that there are many people out there who understand that the two-party system doesn't work for them, who understand that there is no economic opportunity and little hope in their lives, and that the message pushed by the media and for which Reform is a vehicle is that it's not the fault of that billionaire over there, that billionaire with his £400,000 car and his £20 million house. It's not his fault that you were poor and you have nothing. It's actually the fault of that poor immigrant over there who has nothing too. That it's his fault that you're poor. And that's the entire point of Reform, to sidetrack the indignation people feel at the abandonment of the working class and the abandonment of ordinary people and the denigration of the middle class and their drop in social status, and blame it on people of foreign skin rather than blame it on the wealthy and the system of government created by the wealthy, which is what has actually caused poverty for the masses.
You're a former ambassador. What do you make of what's Israel-Palestine? You've already mentioned or talked about, you know, your disgust of this genocide. But as an ambassador, do you see a way out of this situation? I mean, we've been apparently this peace process in Israel and Palestine has been working itself out for, well, I'm thinking pretty much 30 years at least. I mean, the most horrific stages of it since the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin.
There is no peace process. Never has been a peace process. What there is a process by which the extermination and genocide of the Palestinians, which has lasted by 70, for 76 years, comes to be accepted by the governments of, by the corrupt CIA-sponsored governments of Arab states. That's what they call a peace process. It's about normalization of the apartheid state of Israel and its acceptance in international institutions and its acceptance by the political elites of its neighbors. Meanwhile, the situation for the Palestinians just gets worse and worse. But more of them are killed, more of them are raped, more of them are tortured, more of them are imprisoned, and their land is confiscated, their homes are destroyed, their olive trees are cut down year on year on year. And at the moment, we're in a particularly intense period of that. But it's all still part of the same process of genocide, which has been supported by all the Western states pretty well. From the inception, supported very, very strongly by the United States and the United Kingdom as it is today. It's nonsense to even talk of any peace process. There never has been a peace process.
Yeah, but my question really to you is about, do you see prospects for peace? If so, what would they be? If you were Foreign Secretary, what would you be up to?
I don't know. I wouldn't want to be Foreign Secretary, and I certainly wouldn't want to be at see a peace process. What I want to see is the armed resistance of the Palestinian people to the vicious apartheid occupation eventually bring victory.
I mean, that's surely not going to happen. You've got incredibly well-equipped by the Americans and the Brits, by the way, army versus a people with a few small arms.
Absolutely, that's absolutely true, and that's why this is a genocide and not a war. Israel claims it's an armed conflict. I was in the courtroom at the International Court of Justice where they said this is not a genocide, it's an armed conflict. Yet any time the Palestinians shoot back, they say it's terrorism. Well, it can't both be an armed conflict and the people you are fighting cannot be guilty of terrorism if they shoot your soldiers. But, you know, that's a oxymoron. The ridiculous hypocrisy of the situation, the idea, and even the so-called two-state solution, which is impossible, that there's not enough left of a Palestinian state for there to be a two-state solution, that's being put forward by the West involves a demilitarized Palestinian state sitting next to a massively armed Israeli state, which has proven over and over again it has a genocidal intent. But the Palestinians have not surrendered. What we have seen is that you cannot destroy faith and you cannot destroy the national aspiration for freedom with bombs, because Palestine remains undefeated despite being utterly smashed by utterly unequal force. And Israel has lost the world. Israel has lost the support of the entire world. They have lost the anti-Semitism scam. They used to accuse anybody who criticized them at all of anti-Semitism, whereas now everybody sees Israel for the hateful, genocidal institution that it is. So Israel has lost this war. They may feel that they have, you know, succeeded in killing at least 20,000 small children, and that's a great victory for them. But they have destroyed the reputation of their state forever in the eyes of the world, and that's going to work out. It's going to work out through the International Court of Justice, through the International Criminal Court, but it's gradually going to work out in the rejection of the Israeli lobby by the people of the world. And Israel has finally and completely lost the narrative, lost world opinion, just at a time when its main sponsor, the United States, of course, ceases to be the most powerful country in the world. So, no, I don't accept that the Palestinians have lost at all.
Well, yes, but as this plays out, Craig, you're going to see more and more Gazans dead, and it doesn't seem the Israelis care what public opinion around the world thinks. They're just going to carry on killing, and a massacre, which is really more of a massacre than it is a war. Also, there's the aspect of, you know, big powers like China at the United Nations Security Council. Couldn't they be doing more? Shouldn't the Security Council be doing more? Has the UN completely failed?
Everybody should be doing more. The UN has very largely failed. The thing I would like, I think China is a non-assertive superpower. I don't think that any nation in the history of the world has ever achieved the degree of economic dominance that China has currently achieved without seeking military assertion of its influence abroad and imperial conquest to gain more resources. And yet China hasn't done any of those. China proceeds by using soft power. But in that process, China hasn't really flexed its muscles against US hegemony and US atrocities in the same way that sometimes Russia attempts to. Whether, you know, one day China will step up and tell the United States, look, you're just stopping this. We've already seen China intervene beyond its sphere, traditional sphere of influence to, for example, broker some kind of understanding between Saudi Arabia and Iran. So China is starting to get an influence in the region, but all this is slow. I mean, none of this is going to stop. There is no stopping the current genocide in Gaza, but there wouldn't be any way. And this was planned. And anybody who believes that the Americans aren't okay with it, anyone who believes the propaganda about Joe Biden trying to slow it down or stop it or prevent it, or the about the pier the Americans built being for aid, anyone who believes all that propaganda nonsense is an idiot. The Americans are full on part of this genocide, and it's part of a genocidal process that's been going on for 76 years. And we're not going to be able to, in the short term, stop the killing. But ultimately, Israel has lost the world narrative, has lost world support, and ultimately, Israel will disappear, just like apartheid South Africa disappeared and will become a horrible memory of a disgusting aberration in world history.
What about Ukraine? We've had Boris Johnson back in 2016 saying it was the expansion of the EU which led to, which provoked the Russians to invade Ukraine. Exactly the same thing last Friday, by Nigel Farage saying this. And there's a massive hoo-ha right across the press with the Mail on Sunday's headline saying, Nigel Farage has caught the Putin virus, quoting Zelensky. What do you make of this conflict? Because we have now started, NATO weapons and NATO intelligence targeting has been used by the Ukrainians, we're told, to hit strategic Russian sites, such as an airfield where their nuclear bombers are based, a command center in Russia, and also three of their nuclear ballistic missile early warning radars have been hit, apparently by the Ukrainians. But the Russians, certainly the Russian military and in the press, they're saying, well, this is NATO doing this, and maybe we should hit back. What do you make of this conflict?
Yeah, no, what you're saying is absolutely correct. And it's a very good analysis of the most dangerous recent developments. And there's no doubt that the West has deliberately provided Ukraine with long-range weapons and with targeting information and satellite guidance in order to assist the Ukrainians to hit Russian nuclear defenses, in effect, which is the most certain way possible of provoking a nuclear war. Why anybody wants to provoke a nuclear war is rather difficult to understand, but that appears to be what they're trying to do. And the Ukraine war is not winnable. There is no way Ukraine can defeat Russia militarily without inflicting deep into Russia itself the extent of damage which would provoke a nuclear war, and we would all be dead. And we have to answer the question, is that what we want because of some principle about the inviolability of rather strange Soviet borders that cut across the traditional Russian-Ukrainian divide and the Russian-Ukrainian language divide? Do we want to die for that? Or would we rather there was a negotiated settlement in which Ukraine gives up a little bit of its land, some of its land, which is inhabited by Russian speakers who appear to wish to be part of Russia? And it seems to me that the diplomatic solution to this conflict has always been very obvious, and it was very nearly met in Turkey a couple of years ago. I was there in Turkey for those discussions, whereby the Crimea is given up. At that time, it was thought the Donbass would have some kind of special demilitarized status under UN control, and then the Ukraine is the Ukraine. The eventual resolution is not going to look much different to that, except the longer the war goes on, the worse it gets for Ukraine, as Ukraine gradually loses more and more territory. And so that solution will get gradually slightly worse. I used to be a diplomat. I know how you negotiate diplomatic solutions. And either you can have total war, in which one side is utterly defeated and destroyed and devastated and then gets everything, Or you have a negotiated solution. That's the simple choice. It seems to me, as total war, which resulted in a Russian defeat, would result in nuclear annihilation. That's just not a suitable option. Total war, which results in Ukrainian defeat, is certainly possible, wouldn't necessarily result in nuclear destruction, but might well result in nuclear destruction. A negotiated settlement, it was always going to happen. And when it happens, it's not going to look that much different to what it would have looked if they made it 2 years ago. So continuing this war is utter folly.
Can I just finally ask you your thoughts about the release of Julian, though, Craig?
Yes, of course. I'm utterly delighted on a personal level. I'm utterly delighted. I was in floods of tears, and to see Julian back with Stella and with John there, it meant so much to me as an individual, because this has been so much of my life for years and years, campaigning for Julian and helping support the family and helping provide some guidance from time to time. It means everything to me. Of course, the plea deal is very unfortunate, but it was my strong advice. Everybody knows it's coerced. Everything knows it's nonsense. Everything knows you can't have justice with a country that's trying to kill or assassinate you or kidnap you. I don't think people should worry too much about this this silly precedent, because it's only precedent from the lowest of courts. So although it can be used as an example, it's not binding on any other court. So I'm not, I'm just delighted he's home. I'm delighted he's home, and I'm certain when he recovers, his great intellect will be used to advance even further in new areas in future with his radical thought and his anti-war stance, and we will have his leadership back again. And I could not be happier.
And then maybe we'll make him Director General of the BBC.
Yeah, I'm sure if he did that, he would dismantle it totally. So that would be fun.
Craig Murray, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.